It's the perfect example of the Washington politician who'll spend billions of dollars for a headline. When we when Jack had the press release on coinsurance canceling the program, he called me up and he said, "I'm so excited. This is the best press release that we've ever had." And I realized, you know, it was like watching Wag the Dog, that the $9 billion wasn't real. The 36 companies who were going to take terrible hits or go bankrupt were not real. The projects that were being financed were not real. The operations and the staff were not real. The only thing that was real was the press release. The symbolic world was the only world that was real. The concrete world was not real. It was the first time I really grokked the Wag the Dog and Truman Show nature of Washington. Anyway, there are an infinite number of scandal stories, and I'll probably tell some more as we go. One of the things that was happening as this was going on was I bought a house at Woodley Place, and my Auntie Anderson came down from Washington to live there and take care of it, and Gay Cooper came down from Washington to help me decorate it. And so we had this covey of women living at Woodley Place. We bought the house. It was very beautiful. It's a big old New Orleans brownstone over on Woodley Place. It was very beautiful, backed up on Rock Creek Park, and it was great. I'd always sleep with the window open, and I'd wake up in the morning and you could hear the lions roaring at the gym, at the zoo, and all the tropical birds. You know, you felt like you were on safari. It was so beautiful. And it had four fireplaces. It was very elegant, very grand. And it was owned by four gay guys who, one had gotten AIDS and died, and they were all depressed about it, so they wanted to sell both the house and the furniture. And I bought it because I just wanted a nice house. And to get the job, Jack had made me give him a commitment of 4 years, and I knew the real estate market was going to go down a lot, but if it would go down, and then it would go up. So I'd been in the administration for 4 years. So I figured I got $2 million of cash in the bank and really like my own home. So I buy this house, and Gay proceeds to fix it up. And we started to have parties, just because I love parties. I just love having a house that is, I love buying a home and having enough help so that I can just be like a community center. Come on over, let's do this. Let's have a charrette. Let's have a party. Let's all have brunch. I mean, after Pat's funeral, I said to your family, come over tomorrow for brunch. You know, let's commiserate and cry, and we'll watch videos of Pat and, you know, blah, 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 blah. So I just love to have people over and do that. So we started to have parties, some of them business parties, some of them not. And it was really interesting. A friend of mine from New York, Joanne Diaz, she's the same woman who had me go out with Teddy Forsman, decided that we were going to have a party, and she was going to invite all her friends in Washington who she wanted me to meet, and I would invite my friends to have her meet them, and it would be a way for us to meet all of each other's friends. Well, it turns out, totally accidentally, that night was the night that I got sworn in on that afternoon. So then everybody, all my relatives or anybody coming into town for the swearing in, decided that we needed to invite them. So we ended up with an invitation list of like 110 people. So we figured it's Monday night in August, no one will come. Well, lo and behold, every person we invite accepts. And then all these other people are insulted that they're not invited, so we invited them. And it was the same day that Richard Breeden got appointed as chairman of the SEC, and the FIREA bill had, what was it? I guess the FIREA bill had just passed, and we just started the RTC. So David Maxwell came, and Richard came, and Max Warburg's people came, and it just turned out to be like the party of the year, or one of the parties of the year. It was an incredible, incredible night. But I'll never forget Chris Brady's walking up to me and saying, you know, you can't have parties like this because you just can't have parties like this in Washington. And I said, well, Chris, I didn't really intend to have a party like this. It just kind of happened. But one of the great lines from that party, which was so prescient, and I might have told you this in the first day, was Ronnie Rosenfeld was sitting. We had tables in the verandas, we had tables in the living room, we had tables in the bedroom. We were feeding like 120 people. And Ronnie Rosenfeld was sitting at the table with Gay and explained to her why no man in his right mind would ever go out with me because I had such a big, beautiful house. And that leads me to one of my favorite stories about Jack. About, I don't know, a couple months later, I get a ring on the hotline. You have these phones in your office, and there's a hotline from some of the other offices, but certainly from the secretary's office. I pick up the phone, and Jack says, get up here right away. So I go running upstairs, and I walk into Jack's office, and I sit down, and he pulls up in a very intimate way, and he says, I want you to know I think you're a snob. So I said, why do you think I'm a snob? Because that's not something people tend to think of me. And he said, I think you're a snob because you don't associate with principal staff. And I said, but Jack, I've invited principal staff over to my house 5 times for dinners or brunches or parties. And not one of them, matter of fact, has ever invited me back to their house. In fact, Jack, I've invited you to my house 5 times and you've turned me down 5 times. And he looked at me with a look of shock, and he puts his hand on my knee, not in a sexual way, but just like in a fatherly way. And he says, he says, Austin, I could never come to your house. Your house is bigger than my house. I would find it castrating. So, of course, I'm sitting here in the office of the cabinet secretary. He's got his hand on my knee, and he's telling me that he finds my house castrating. Now, what do you do with that? But I was trained on Wall Street, so, you know, by Wall Street standards, this is, you know, this is daily goings on. So I said, Jack, you go to Sherry Rollins. And Sherry was Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs and was married to Ed Rollins, who had been Jack's campaign manager. I said, you go to Sherry Rollins' house, and Sherry Rollins' house is bigger than my house. And if Sherry Rollins' house is bigger than my house, it must be bigger than your house. And he looked at me like I was the stupidest woman in America, and he said, Austin, that's not Sherry's house. That's Ed's house. Anyway, so I left the office that time thinking, I'm not sure how I'm gonna be effective at this agency. anyway, I would go from this environment at HUD, which was so a combination of mean, immature, and incapable of taking operational and financial accountability for the world whole or for their own actions, and then go back to this beautiful home with a bunch of women who were the opposite, who were not famous, not pretentious, not ambitious, and who saw the whole world whole, and who enjoyed giving praise. It was a frightening contrast. One of the things that happened right away when I got there was that Della Bovee, the number two guy, Scott Reed, the chief of staff, Mary Burnett, Kemp's number one policy person, all just decided to declare war on me. And it's interesting to posit why. I think they just wanted to make sure that I had as little power as possible, because I think they understood that my values were different than theirs, and the faster they could get me out, the safer they would be. I think each was a person who perceived that the way to succeed with Jack was to do evil. And to have a very weak lynch mobby kind of group, and that I was not compatible with that. The other thing is, I think that when I first got to Washington, I was someone who attracted an awful lot of positive response in Congress and in the press, and they and Jack were concerned that that would somehow diminish his star, so that they wanted to do everything they could to make sure that I was perceived as non-existent or gotten gone. Della Bovee clearly wanted to control the money, and felt that the best way to do that was to destroy me and get me out of there and put a token in charge. And so Della Bovee was constantly trying to clip my wings, and there's an infinite number of Della Bovee stories, and maybe I'll get into some of them as we go through this. The first big issue that came up, sort of turf war, was that the accounting group that did all the accounting and the servicing for FHA reported to the Assistant Secretary of Admin, and I wanted that group moved over to report to me so that I could create a financially accountable operation. I also wanted independent audited financial statements and independent audited actuarial studies. And I wanted to computerize the operation. My those were my biggest goals while I was there, was to create the financial reporting and financial internal controls and systems by law that could make it possible to run the organization on a financially sound basis. I was able to get that accomplished because Chuck Bowser, who was the head of the General Accounting Office, helped me with his congressional testimony and sort of formal opinions. Also, I and my deputies were extremely effective in educating and persuading OMB to our view of things. And I was able to get Delabovi finally and Jack to agree with me before they realized the ramifications of having a financially accountable organization. One of the ways that some of these things happened was Frank Keating persuaded Jack at some point in early 89, I guess mid-89, that we ought to do a reform bill. And Jack agreed, and then Frank got his lawyers in the room and wrote 300 pages of complete garbage. And it was such a mess. What I did was I took my team, and in fact the laptop computers we brought down from New York, and I sent them in, and they sat in a room and they deleted all 300 pages line by line by line. It was one of the most painful things we'd ever managed to do. And then we proceeded to invent and write a reform bill that was organized around sort of how the money works and what it takes in genuine fashion to redesign or reformulate the system as a system to what it takes to reform the system to accomplish the stated goals of the organization as defined by the secretary. It was interesting, after we wrote the whole package, I remember sitting on a plane with Blackwell, who looked at me like I was an idiot and said, "Don't you realize that you invented and wrote all of this, and the contribution of everybody else in the agency was to put a whole bunch of stuff that you had to get rid of that could have messed it all up, and now these guys have this fabulous package, and it's, you know, being heralded as, you know, making Jack the leader in good government and financial reform and Mr. Clean and whatever, and what you have here is a just like a grand slam politically. Don't you realize what you've done?" And that's when I looked at, I'll never forget looking at Blackwell and feeling a feeling that I felt it with Jack so many times, which was that the world doesn't understand that the source of all wealth is God. And another way to say it is knowledge. And knowledge is infinite. It's not finite, it's infinite. And particularly for me, financial knowledge is just infinite. And it's so funny, Jack used to look at me and say, sometimes with this guilty look, and he said, "Don't you hate me for stealing your ideas?" And I'd say, "No, Jack. My job is to feed you ideas. Your job is to use them as you see fit. That's my job." But what I realized was he thought that great ideas were finite. And I knew that great ideas were infinite. And I could never understand their feelings of deprivation and lack, or their hatred of me, because I couldn't feel those feelings. It was so unusual. The reform package for me was a blessing, because what I wanted was to embed actuarial analysis and audited financial statements and a controller and a few other things in the law. And once we got it in the law, it was done, and the reform package went through. I sent over to you a cassette of the press conference that we had on the reform package, And it's so funny to watch it because in it, I'm so cold. And I had been so trained and beaten up by Jack and his people to not be charismatic or in any way warm or appealing to the press, because that was the number one sin. If I was warm and appealing to the press, I was dead meat. It's funny, you look at the thing and I think, ugh, cold, horrible. Anyway, but you have something on the reform package. You can get a sense of it. What was also interesting from going back and watching that video is the extent to which the group involved didn't understand how the money works or have intellectual mastery over the financial issues. And they were always feeling insecure or jealous around me because of that. And the funny thing was, is that that was simply a matter of taking the time to sit down and learn them. And certainly I was available to teach all of them. But they would never take the time or spend the energy to really sit down and get mastery of them. And then they would get jealous of me because I would. I could never, I always thought it was a girl guy thing. I could never understand. I could never understand why the left brain guys wouldn't want to learn the substance. It just seemed to me it'd be really dangerous in this world to be a left brain guy if you didn't understand the substance. One of the programs that I recommended were canceled. I must have recommended and gotten canceled about 10 programs. Was Title 10, which was a land program in single family. There was, most of the problems were in multifamily, but single family had some real doozies. Our favorite one was the home improvement loan that a guy had, a developer had used to finance his divorce. And his argument was it really improved his home. Title 10 was, it turned out, was the major fee source for the president of the home builders, who had tried to place her guy in single family, who I spoke about on the first tape. And we got it canceled. It was front page New York Times, and we later, in one of the first loan sales, sold off the defaulted portfolio, which was sort of an interesting, reminiscing moment. But I'm sure that when I canceled it, the president and the home builders were not that happy, because you had both the president, but the another one of the incoming presidents had a deal and problems in it, and so it was another political hotbed. About this time was when I decided that maybe what could help dealing with Jack and his staff was to have regular briefings, and I had a very strong deputy team. I had set it up so that I had politicals, but then deputies behind them. And so in the commissioner's office, I had an extremely weak general deputy, which I'll talk about later, Peter Munro, and then a strong career deputy, Jim Schoenberger. And then I had in each, Jim Logue in multifamily, Ronnie Rosenfeld in single family, and then Russ, I moved Russ Davis over and put him in charge of operations, but had a very strong career staff. And so we decided we would brief Jack to try and make sure he had some basic literacy on the operation and what we did. So one of the first times I went upstairs, and two things happened at the briefing. One, my team of deputies was extremely, the only way I can describe it is they were extremely masculine. they're all very